From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format for you tonight, last 2 hours, Climate Gate with Brian Sussman. Congratulations, by the way, to the Chicago Blackhawks, this year's Hockey Stanley Cup winners, defeating a tough Philadelphia Flyers team. It's been 49 years since the Blackhawks took home the cup. Lord Stanley would be proud. Here's what's happening. McDonald's will recall about 12 million Shrek drinking glasses because federal regulators found that they contain the toxic metal cadmium, which can pose health risks. The glasses had been sold for $2 apiece at McDonald's restaurants across the country as a promotional tie-in with the popular movie. Purchasers will be advised to keep them away from children and to return them to McDonald's for a refund. The recall by the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission was set in motion by an anonymous tip last week, which in turn, they tested the glasses on an accelerated basis, and they have confirmed the presence of cadmium. Jeff Nelkin, who's our food safety expert on the line with us here. Jeff, this happens time and time again. Why don't they check these things before they go out to the public?
Well, George, you know, again, it's a good point why they didn't do the thorough testing. It seems also that they're changing the, you know, there's a sliding scale on how much of this cadmium they were actually identifying as being dangerous. So McDonald's is kind of being erring on the side where they don't want any risk to their customers.
They don't say where the Shrek glasses came from, but I suspect probably from China.
In one of the references I looked at, I thought originally that too. But they said these Shrek glasses that are being recalled were made in the United States.
Oh, really?
So that'll be interesting to see if, in fact, that's true, or if they're just kind of trying to protect, you know, any negative exposure to the Chinese.
Good point. Okay.
System.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll check that out. Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In England, there were 1,200 fewer hospital admissions for heart attacks in England in the year after July 2007. What's so important about that? That's when their smoking ban came in. A 2.4% drop was much more modest than reported in some areas where similar bans have been introduced. A census in Indonesia has now identified a 157-year-old woman named Tarina of South Sumatra. If it's true, she can claim to be the oldest living being on Earth. She has reportedly been born in 1853 and has a 108-year-old adopted daughter. She speaks Dutch fluently, works in her house, has clear memory, undisturbed sight, and no problems of hearing. She loves to smoke clove cigarettes. The only authentic record of anyone crossing 120 years of age was a French woman, Jean Calmet, who died in 1997 at the age of 122. Can you imagine that? If she's 157 years old, and she's still very healthy. The largest ever genetic study into autism has identified many more new genes involved in this disorder. Oxford researchers writing in the journal Nature hope now to establish whether genetic tests can help in making early diagnosis. The team also says the discovery of new genes could help them identify some of the drugs to combat the symptoms. Autism is a disorder of neural development. In a moment, Dr. Andrew Wakefield joins us. He's the doctor who linked autism to vaccines. Gulf Coast fishermen, businesses, and property owners who have filed damage claims with BP over the oil spill are now complaining of delays, excessive paperwork, and skimpy payments that have put them on the verge of going under as the financial and environmental toll of this disaster grows by the day. Out in the Gulf of Mexico, meanwhile, the oil company claims to have captured a larger share of the crude gushing from the bottom of the sea and began bringing in more heavy equipment to handle it. And BP stock, by the way, sank to its lowest point in 14 years as investors feared the company would be overwhelmed by the costs of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The stock dropped today by 16%. So far, the company has lost half its market value, a stunning 95 billion dollars. Catherine Austin Fitz with us as she looks at economic measures. Catherine, $95 billion market value loss for this company. How much more can they sustain?
They can sustain another $95 billion of losses.
And then what happens?
Well, and then they, you know, I doubt that it'll go that low. What you would see is somebody else take them over. There are a number of things you could do. You could basically put the liabilities in one entity and then have the remainder of their assets spun out and somebody else take them over. I mean, there are a couple of things that can happen, George, but there's no doubt that what's happening could, in theory, we may not see BP as an independent company this time next year.
If this continues, if they can get this capped soon, do you think they'll be okay?
Well, there's a deeper problem, and it's why investors are so concerned right now. If you look at the way we run our money, our investment, whether it's a household, whether it's a mutual fund company, whether it's big pension funds, whether you're in Asia, Europe, or here, what we say is, look, all we care about is the return to the investor. We don't care about the health of the ecosystem, whether it's the financial ecosystem or any part of the living ecosystem. We just track. We don't track what I call total economic return or the return to the ecosystem. We just track what we get. Now, if you wander around the world, everybody on the planet is making money increasingly in ways that harm somebody else. And so until we start to look at the total economic return of our investments and use that as a navigation tool to do everything we can to have a positive total economic return, we're going to keep seeing companies get hurt. Because what happens is, if you don't care about what you're doing to the ecosystem, then you're going to take on risk that you don't understand, and your investors are ultimately going to get knocked. And that's happening. If you look system-wide, we're now in a situation where a company considered to be stronger than many countries, it's inconceivable that something like this could happen to BP. But look at what's happening, and that's because they and the companies they're operating on are operating in a system where everybody, including all their shareholders, are saying, you know, I only care about me. Well, if everybody only cares about me, there will be no, you know, there will be no market. And literally, that's why investors are afraid, because the fundamental conditions that make for a functioning market are diminishing, and that's what's going to have to be changed. And the BP situation is a very, you know, it's a very painful one, because if you look at the amount of economic activity and economic value that they're destroying in the all along the Gulf, I mean, in theory, we BP shareholders will lose, you know, $95 billion plus $95 billion. But the Southeast economy will lose $2+ trillion or more.
For a long, long time. Catherine, thank you so much. Now, here's a mix-up that's bound to send shivers down parents' spines. Delta Airlines accidentally put a girl bound for Cleveland on a Boston flight last night and stuck a boy bound for Boston on a Cleveland plane. Here's Delta's statement. Well, we apologize to the families. We re-accommodated the children to their final destination cities at no cost. We arranged full refunds for the children's tickets. We provided credits to the families for future travel, and we refunded their unaccompanied minor fees. How about that? Apple has suffered another embarrassment. A security breach has exposed iPad owners, including dozens of CEOs, military officials, and top politicians. They and every other buyer of the wireless-enabled tablet could be vulnerable to spam marketing and malicious hacking. The breach, which comes just weeks after an Apple employee lost an iPhone prototype in a bar, exposed the most exclusive email list on the planet, a collection of early adopter iPad 3G subscribers that includes thousands of A-listers in finance, politics, and media. Security consultant Kevin Mitnick with us. Kevin, how serious is this, anyway?
Somewhat. I mean, the only thing that was breached was an email address. So what the hackers were able to do is find a flaw in it's not Apple, by the way. This was completely AT&T's fault. They found a flaw in AT&T's website that allowed them to input random what they call integrated circuit card identifiers. That's like a number on a SIM card. And then when they put in that number, which is ordinarily on your SIM card, on this micro SIM card, it actually retrieved that person's email address. So what a hacker could do is map SIM cards to email addresses. The worst thing that could happen is with that information, a hacker could possibly call AT&T, pretend to be that customer, give AT&T the circuit card identification number, and maybe do some social engineering to do stuff on that person's account. But this is definitely not the fault of Apple Computer. It's actually AT&T. And, you know, I've had personal experience with AT&T, and their security is really pretty bad, pretty scary.
It sure is. Now, how old are these hackers, Kevin? What do you think? 20s, 30s, 40s?
Probably between 20 and 30. It was actually a security group, I guess a group of security researchers that found it by mistake. And then I guess they responsibly disclosed it to AT&T and then went to the media about it. But I wouldn't be fearful. I mean, I have an iPad 3G, and I'm not worried if somebody has my email address and SIM card ID. I really don't think it's such a big deal, but it could be used for spam. So if somebody was able to retrieve all those email addresses and they know those are all iPad 3G customers, that list is probably valuable to the spamming community.
Well, that's a good point. Thank you, Kevin. The Elvis Presley estate has signed a deal for Hasbro and PPW Toys to release an Elvis version of Mr. Potato Head. The new toy is one of 15,000 Elvis licensed products and is one of the things the company is very excited about. The first of the Elvis Potato Heads will be released for the Elvis Tribute Week in August. The toy will be in a jumpsuit, and a second version with the likeness dressed in black leather will be on the market for Christmas. Man, what they won't think of next. Up next, we will be talking with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Callous Disregard is his work. Autism and Vaccines, the Truth Behind a Tragedy. What a story. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight, you're going to hear the side of Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Let me tell you a little bit about the story that has gone on worldwide over the past couple of weeks. A doctor who persuaded millions of parents worldwide that a common vaccine could cause autism was barred from practicing medicine in his native Britain after the country's top medical group found that he conducted his research unethically. Dr. Andrew Wakefield was the first researcher to publish a peer-reviewed study suggesting a connection between autism and the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. That prompted many parents to abandon the vaccine in moves that epidemiologists feared could lead to outbreaks of the potentially deadly disease. Now, tonight, Dr. Wakefield will tell his side of the story. He is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital's Medical School, part of the University of London, in 1981, and he pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He has published more than 130 original scientific articles, book chapters, and invited scientific commentaries. His work tonight, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind a Tragedy. Here's Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be with you.
Let's start, first of all, if you can, just tell me a little bit about how you uncovered this connection between autism and the vaccine.
Well, you know, it's really a very simple story, and it starts as all medical stories should begin, and that's in the clinic. And it starts by listening to the patient or to the patient's parents. And that's the essence of good medicine. And in May 1995, parents started calling me and saying my child was perfectly normal. They were speaking, they were interacting up to 15 months of age. They then had an MMR vaccine. They had a prolonged fever. They were never quite the same again. They then started to slip away, lose their skills. They could no longer speak or interact with their siblings. They wouldn't play. They would sit in a corner just doing the same thing time and time and time again. And eventually they were diagnosed with autism. And I said, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm a gastroenterologist. I know nothing about autism. When I was at medical school, it was so rare that we weren't even taught about it. And the parents said, well, the problem is my child has terrible gastrointestinal problems. The doctor dismisses them out of hand, but they've got diarrhea, bloating. I know they're in pain. They've lost the ability to speak. They're banging their head against a wall, and I know it's because they're in pain. And I'm sure what's going on in their intestine is related to what's going on in their behavior and their brain function.
And so, go ahead. Go ahead.
So what we did, quite simply, was what we are professionally and morally obliged to do, and that is to take the parent's story to investigate those children, and lo and behold, they had a bowel disease. They had an intestinal disease which the medical profession had ignored, had dismissed, and had said, your kid's autistic, they're just bound to have these problems. Well, that is not true. And when we treated the bowel disease with standard anti-inflammatory treatment that we would give for patients with Crohn's or colitis, then not only did the bowel symptoms get better, the diarrhea improved, the pain disappeared, but the behavior improved and the autistic features improved. And that was the beginning of a very, very interesting, if somewhat turbulent, journey.
And let's point this out from the outset. You are not opposed to vaccines specifically, are you?
Not at all. Absolutely not. I am for a safety-first vaccination policy. And that has to be absolutely the key. Why would anyone resist a safety-first vaccine policy? If you're going to administer vaccines to healthy children, indeed all the children of the world, that is the intention, then you have to be absolutely certain that you have done everything to determine the safety of the vaccines and the schedule. And that is what I'm in favor of.
I was opposed to the H1N1 vaccine because I thought that they rushed it too soon, and I truly question sometimes the motives of Big Pharma. And you know, in your particular situation, tell me what happened. Why were you barred from practicing medicine in Britain? What happened? What's the politics behind that?
Well, the main charge against my colleagues and I, and my colleagues included the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist. Please bear this in mind. Your listeners need to know that Professor John Walker Smith was the founding father of the discipline of pediatric gastroenterology. So a man who's now retired, but who has had an unimpeachable career. He has devoted his life to the care of children. And the charge against us was that we conducted unethical research on these children without the appropriate approvals. We did not. We absolutely did not. These children were investigated for their clinical symptoms. This was clinical medicine. It was like a child going to a doctor with a sore throat and having a throat swab done, a blood test done. It was no more than that. It was saying, what are the presenting symptoms in these children, and therefore, what are the tests that need to be done to get to their diagnosis? And the regulatory body in the UK, the General Medical Council, said this was research. It was not. It most specifically was not. There was a research element to the work that was done by me, and that was looking in great detail and the microscope at the tissues, the biopsies taken from these children during their clinical colonoscopy. And we did that to characterize the disease, and that research was covered by an appropriate ethical committee approval. And how the GMC confused this is so bizarre, and I describe this in the book Callous Disregard, present the factual evidence so that people can judge for themselves, that led me to believe that their minds were made up before we ever went into the chamber and before ever a word of evidence was heard.
Well, you know, Dr. Wakefield, you're stepping on the toes of a multi-billion dollar industry, and they don't want you talking, do they?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and you characterized it well with the H1N1 scenario. There you have a scare created, a pandemic predicted, what turns out to be a mountain made out of a molehill. It was one of the mildest flu viruses on record, and the drug companies made an absolute killing on this. And there is a great deal of anxiety now in the European Parliament, where the committee that ordered this, an internal committee at the World Health Organization, is under investigation because many people on that committee actually were representing the pharmaceutical industry and were paid by them as consultants. And that kind of conflict of interest is unacceptable, and it led the taxpayer to having to fork out for what was, it turns out to be, no problem at all. And the major problem was that a vaccine that was untested for safety was rushed onto the market. And I think there have been a large number of problems occurring in terms of adverse reactions following that.
All right, Andrew, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come right back and talk about your work, Callous Disregard. It's an incredible story. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And with our special guest, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, he'll be with us next hour as well. We'll take some phone calls with him next hour. We've got him for 2 hours tonight, and we'll be back with him as we continue talking about his work, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, the Truth Behind a Tragedy. We're with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who blew the lid on the connection between autism and vaccines, the MMR vaccine specifically. Dr. Andrew, what was it about that vaccine that you found that you just didn't like?
Well, when I got involved in this, I went back into the history of the safety studies of vaccines before they were licensed, and I wrote a 250-page report which analyzed all of the safety studies looking at measles right the way through to its when it was combined as measles, mumps, rubella. And I have to say I was appalled by the studies. They were not only inadequate, but they were short-term. They lasted for no more than 3 or 4 or 5 weeks at the most. And these are viruses that can hang around and cause long-term problems. And there were no long-term safety studies at all. And I put this to my colleagues. I said, there is a major problem here. The studies have not been done. And in particular, my worry was that when you combine three live viruses in one mixture and do not do adequate safety testing on it, then you're going to run into trouble because those viruses interfere with each other. If I went to the Food and Drug Administration with three blood pressure drugs, and I said, I've taken these three drugs and put them in the same tablet, and I want to give them to a patient because I've done the safety studies on the individual tablets, they would throw me out the door. They would show me the door and say, you're going to kill people if you do this because these drugs will potentiate the adverse reaction risk. And that is exactly what seems to have happened with the combination MMR.
Now, you, as you were doing your work, you had an opportunity to talk with a government whistleblower. His name was George as well. And what did he tell you? What were his revelations?
Yes, his code name was George. And George was brought across from Canada in 1987 to advise the British government on the introduction of MMR, where they'd already introduced it in Canada. Canada had introduced a vaccine called Trivirix, which had to be withdrawn very early on because it caused meningitis. It was unsafe. That same vaccine was rebranded, just given a new name, the exact same vaccine called Pluserix, and licensed in the UK in the same month that it was withdrawn in Canada. And this was an extraordinary situation. The British government or the regulatory authorities in the UK were aware that it had been withdrawn in Canada because it was dangerous, and yet they introduced it in the UK. And that is a measure of how much I think they care about the issue of safety. And George had advised them not to introduce it because of the problems, and they ignored him. And over the next 4 years, there were repeated problems with the vaccine, with increasing numbers of cases of meningitis in the UK. These were ignored, they were dismissed, and finally, a small amount of money was put into a study in a university in Nottingham in England, which showed beyond doubt the rate of meningitis with this vaccine was very much higher than had previously been thought. The vaccine was withdrawn overnight, and the vaccine, sadly, not taken off the market, but then shipped out to developing countries where it has also caused epidemics of meningitis. So a very questionable ethical and moral practice, the British government introducing a vaccine that was knowingly unsafe. And the rub to this, the real problem underlying this, is that when I got involved in this, there was a legal action by parents against the manufacturers, and they thought, and I thought, and the lawyers thought it was against the manufacturers, but it wasn't. As it turns out, and as George disclosed to me, the government had underwritten the liability of the company because the company, SmithKline-Beecham, had said, we don't want to introduce this vaccine because it's unsafe.
Oh, I think my gosh.
It's extraordinary. Extraordinary situation.
And you know, Andrew, we see this time and time again here in the United States where the FDA will approve some kind of pill, some drug, and then a year later, 2 years later, they've got to yank it off the market because people are dying. People are getting sick from these things. Why do they rush these things to marketplace?
Well, it is extraordinary. This relationship between the regulators and The pharmaceutical industry is something that's a complete mystery to me and is certainly not something that operates in the patient's best interests. And it's something that really needs to be put right. Because
I mean, we even knew it passed in the years gone past. I think they've changed it now. But, you know, pharmaceutical companies were able to take doctors on trips and, you know, just kind of like make them feel very welcome. And then the doctors, of course, would recommend that specific drug because he was thinking about the company all the time.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem. And the most recent problem that's really thrown this into sharp relief is the fact that one of the publishing companies that publishes a lot of reputable scientific journals was producing fake publications that looked like scientific journals, which were actually sponsored by Merck Pharmaceuticals and were extremely favorable to their drugs. So there you have a perversion of the scientific process where people are led to believe when they read these magazines that they are true scientific articles when they are, in fact, are not.
Has this vaccine, the MMR vaccine that you believed was responsible for autism, has this specific vaccine been changed now where it's no longer a threat, or is it still out there?
So it's still out there, and the consensus amongst the regulators is there's no problem. And you hear from the government, there's no problem, there's no link. And yet, George, what has been going on since 1991 in this country is the vaccine courts, the government vaccine courts, have been settling cases of vaccine-induced autism. They have confirmed that vaccines, including MMR vaccine, can cause or materially contribute to autism. So you've got one branch of the government saying, yes, there is proof, settling these cases. And on the other hand, you've got them saying that it's safe. Now, which is true?
Yeah.
I have a clear feeling of which I believe is true.
Actress and comedian Jenny McCarthy, who's got a little boy named Evan, has autism as well. She, of course, is a staunch believer of the connection between autism and vaccines. She's very vocal about that. Are you beginning to get more and more support in spite of what things like your native country has done to you?
Yes, I think that this is what they fear most of all and why they have to try and silence me by taking away my license, which they won't do. I'm not going to walk away from this. The problem is too big. Wherever I go in the world, I was in China recently, there is a huge problem. They have 4 to 5 million children, they estimate, with autism, and the story is exactly the same. And these parents aren't anti-vaccine. They took their children to be vaccinated on time, and their children regressed following the vaccine. Now, that doesn't prove that the vaccine was the cause, but it makes it absolutely essential that it is investigated to the ends of the earth to establish whether or not there is a relationship.
Isn't that the big issue right now? And this is one of the things you really want. You just want a major, no conflict of interest investigation.
That's absolutely right. It's essential, and it is essential not only to establish whether there is a relationship or not, but to underpin public confidence in vaccination policy. Because as soon as the public lose confidence in vaccine policymakers, then it destroys vaccine policy potentially across the board. And that leads to potential catastrophe. And so those who are ultimately anti-vaccine are the ones who refuse to do these studies, who will not invest in the safety examination of these vaccines properly, and who deny children who are injured some kind of safety net, some kind of compensation by denying vaccine injury. Because then parents will lose confidence, and all the good that vaccination has done will be destroyed virtually overnight.
Dr. Andrew Wakefield, tell me a little bit about autism, this affliction. Exactly what is it? What does it do?
Right. It was described by a doctor called Leo Kanner in 1943. It was first described then, so it seems that it did not exist in any recognizable form before that time. It's described according to its behavioral features, in other words, how the child presents to you at that time in the clinic. And it is characterized by lack of socialization, lack of communication, repetitive behaviors, loss of eye contact or absence of eye contact, absence of overt emotion or physical and emotional contact with peers, no interest in play, this kind of thing. It's a socially devastating problem. But beyond the behavioral aspects are clear physical problems with these children. Their immune system isn't working well. Their intestines are not functioning. functioning properly. And there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that the intestine may be the source of the problem in many, many children, which sounds to people rather confusing. But in fact, the link between the bowel and the brain is one that's firmly established in medicine. We are, if you like, what we eat. And toxins from the intestine can undoubtedly have an impact upon brain and behavior. So it's now becoming increasingly recognized that this is a much more than just a neurological or a brain disease. It's a what we call a systemic or whole body disease. And the recognition of that has led to huge advances in our understanding and treatment of the problem. And Jenny McCarthy's little boy, Evan, is the beneficiary of that that knowledge and that intervention, and the fact that he's got a determined mother who's going to get to the bottom of the problem, and he's doing very well.
Absolutely, and that's good news. Why do they say that children who have this compulsion with stacking things up and being orderly, why do they say that's autistic? To me, that's almost genius.
Well, it would be wonderful if it were meaningful. This is the problem, is if it were done for the purpose of tidying up their bedroom, for example, that would be wonderful. But it's a repetitive exercise which could go on for hours and hours and hours, and does not actually have any achievement. So what they will do is they will watch the same segment of a video, say Thomas the Tank Engine, and they will watch the same segment for hours and hours, rewinding, going back, doing it again. And it is a reflection of a perseveration, if you like, that is clearly abnormal and not consistent with, I've seen that, I've done that, move on and find out what the next bit shows. And so it's something that is a fundamental part of the autistic syndrome and something which we need to understand a great deal more about.
If this was first beginning to be discovered in 1943, when did the vaccine come out?
The MMR vaccine did not come along till much later. And no one is saying that all autism is caused by vaccines. Indeed, we know that there were cases of autism before vaccines came along that were caused by, for example, the drug thalidomide,
the drug
that caused limb abnormalities.
Right, they look like little flippers, right?
That's right. Sodium valproate, another drug that can cause autism, taken by the mother during pregnancy. And George, the really interesting thing as far as this argument is concerned, it is that it is known that exposure during pregnancy to viruses such as measles, mumps, and rubella, or early in the period after pregnancy, can lead to autism. And so there you have historical evidence that these three viruses in their natural form can be associated with autism in the child. So is it possible that when you put them together in the combination, they increase that risk? And that is something that certainly merits investigation.
Did we see a spike in autism once the vaccine came out?
Yes, there's a paper that's just come out, extremely interesting paper, which looked at the time trends in the number of new children presenting with autism. And it shows a clear sort of hockey stick effect in the UK, in Japan, and around the world when the MMR vaccine was introduced. It narrows it down to a 2 to 3 year time window, which is quite extraordinary. And pinpoint the change in that, in the shape of that curve, the incidence curve, to that point. And so the data are certainly consistent with the disease taking off with the introduction of that vaccine.
There was an expert witness who was giving evidence against you, criticizing you for not disclosing what he called a conflict of interest during your research. I want you to explain that and also explain the fact that wasn't that person, that witness, also being paid by the government and drug companies to do his own research?
Yes. Now, this is the person you refer to is the sort of doyen of autism in the UK, Professor Sir Michael Rutter. And he was an expert witness against me and my colleagues at the General Medical Council. And in addition, he has appeared in US Vaccine Court and the UK Vaccine Court on behalf of the defendants, that is the government or the pharmaceutical companies. Now, he, ironically, was the first to describe the link between vaccines and autism. So people say Dr. Wakefield was the first. In fact, in 1994, Professor Rutter produced a paper showing that one child that he described had regressed into autism following immunization. And he labeled it as the probable cause, which is something that we never said. So, you know, if we're irresponsible, then he is highly irresponsible. What we said is that this study, our original study, never proves an association, let alone a causal association. So we were very sober in our in any contentions that we made. But Rutter stood up at the General Medical Council and said that because I had agreed to undertake a study on behalf of the lawyers, a research study in the UK, that this should have been disclosed in the Lancet paper, the paper in 1998 that first described the syndrome. Well, none of the children in that study, none of them, were at the time of their referral to the Royal Free Hospital, were involved in litigation. So there was no conflict.
Now, you've suggested the connection between autism and the vaccines, but you do say we don't know for sure one way or another. We don't know if it's the vaccine, and or we don't know that it is the is not the vaccine. In these particular cases, what percent of children that just get a vaccine end up coming down with autism?
It's a very good question, George, and we don't have the answer to that. And that is the reason for that is that causation is highly complex. And let me just characterize that in a nutshell, that people in this country have suggested that the thimerosal preservative, the mercury preservative, which is in other vaccines, not the MMR, may also be involved. And that's entirely right. Plausible because that substance, mercury, ethyl mercury, a preservative that should never, ever have been in the vaccine because it's highly toxic, can damage the immune system. So if your immune system is hit with successive vaccines containing this mercury compound, and then you get an MMR on top of it, a live viral vaccine, the immune system may just put up its hands and say, I don't get it. So you have a complex interaction between these things, potentially. And this is something that's never been looked at. No one has ever done a safety study of the schedule that children actually get in the real world. We've now done that study, a primate study using rhesus macaque monkeys, asking just that question. What are the neurological and the intestinal and the immune consequences of giving the schedule? And the results are starting to emerge now, and they're really quite alarming.
Well, and we've seen things happen time and time again. The simian virus situation for fighting and combating polio, growing this on monkey kidneys and, you know, harvesting things like that. What is it, in your opinion, because I'm sure there's some great researchers out there who really want to make a difference. They want to put a dent into disease and afflictions. How much does the money end of it weigh? You know, profit, let's get these things out the marketplace, let's make money. And how much of it is we truly want to help humanity? What's the weighing percent there?
Well, I think from the scientist's point of view and the medical point of view, clearly the will is to do good for the people. For the pharmaceutical companies, the interest is the bottom line. It is the stock price. It is returns to shareholders. And that is their principal concern. They have to abide by certain safety rules, but that is not, I have to say, their priority in my experience. One example of this is the latest debacle over the rotavirus vaccine, where they have said, oh, it's been tested in millions of children and it's absolutely safe. And then way down the line, after it's been given, millions of doses have been given, they find that it contains the genetic material of two pig viruses, one of which is known to cause a wasting fatal disease in young pigs. Now, that's appalling. That's an utter disgrace that years down the line, this virus is found in there. When they found it in one vaccine, they took it off the market. When they found it in both vaccines, they put both vaccines back on the market. That, to me, is absolutely extraordinary and unacceptable. And one of the regulators said the benefits of this vaccine far outweigh the potential risks. That is totally dishonest because they have absolutely no knowledge of the medium or long-term risks of that pig virus in those vaccines, none at all. And so to mislead the American public by saying that the benefits greatly outweigh the risks is entirely false.
Okay, will you stay with us, Andrew? We will talk for one more hour. We're going to open up the phone lines next as we continue our dialogue. Is work callous disregard? Autism and vaccines, the truth behind a tragedy. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.